Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Tuesday, June 11th, 2013. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. The Sitka Economic Development Association, or SEDA, wants to find out if Sitka is a good place to mine for gold. SEDA is expected to ask the Assembly tonight for more than $72,000 from the Southeast Economic Development Fund. It would use the money to pay for a geologic survey along 8 miles of road from Sawmill Cove to Green Lake. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Avalon Development, based in Fairbanks, would send geologists to Sitka for about a week. They would collect samples for analysis at their Fairbanks lab, and what they learn from those samples would become public after the work is completed. SEDA Executive Director Gary White.
We think there might be gold mining or mining available here. We're not positive. This will take us down that step for us to determine that, and at the same time, it's going to be a barometer to see where people lie, whether they think that having this type of industry and the benefits that come with it are acceptable to the community or not.
At SEDA's Economic Development Summit back in April, attendees voted on mining as one of the top ways to improve Sitka's economy. White says if that development comes to pass, there are potential benefits for the community.
The two mines in Juneau pay $2.7 million in property tax to that community. That helps our schools. That helps us as a community overall. A lot of really high-paying jobs, and that's kind of the mission of SEDA is to bring family wage jobs and investment to town, and we're kind of investigating it.
Not everyone is so sure it's a good idea. Andrew Tomes is executive director of the Sitka Conservation Society.
I don't know if this is the best use of the city's economic development fund. There's a long history of mining claims in Silver Bay that have been dubious in the past. Historically, they're known as being scams.
Gold mining had its heyday in Sitka, starting in about the 1870s. But as the 20th century approached, the industry faltered. In one case, a mine manager was trying to find ways to feed the operations in Sitka, and so he sent out prospectors to find new mines. One of those prospectors was named Joseph Juno. And as his last name might suggest, instead of bringing business back to Sitka, he put a different Alaska city on the map. Meanwhile, back in Sitka, developers were claiming high-value veins of gold, but they were basing those claims on samples purposely loaded with valuable ore. A report drawn up by Avalon in April 2012 documents the historical infamy and malfeasance of Sitka's early prospectors. But it also says while there's no guarantee Sitka will hold significant deposits, there's nothing ruling it out either, and that it's worth a look. Tomes says the Sitka Conservation Society has concerns about the environmental impact of mining, but mostly he's skeptical the city needs to be involved at all.
If anyone was really interested in mineral potential at Silver Bay, that company would pay for the exploration themselves. Why should the city be paying for mineral exploration? The free market will find that with the high prices for gold and ore. They'd figure that out pretty quickly.
Which is the next question. If there is gold to be mined here, why hasn't someone done so already? The Avalon study from 2012 blames a number of factors, including regulatory, environmental, and political fights in the 1980s and 90s that turned the industry off to Southeast Alaska. The report also says SEDA should measure local support or opposition toward gold mining before proceeding with exploration. Tomes says if Sitka is going to pursue further mining, it should be for rock, which the city needs. As for gold, SEDA's Gary White says there's plenty of time to take the region's temperature.
The average time before someone starts to where we're starting today in an operating mine is well over 15 years. So we have to take a step somewhere. This is the first step.
Avalon and SEDA present the plan to the Sitka Assembly at a 5 p.m. work session tonight. That's followed at 6 p.m. by the regular meeting where the request for funding will be heard. Raven Radio will provide live coverage of the meeting beginning at 6. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
A smaller stopgap Sea Alaska land bill is on the back burner, at least for now. But the full measure is scheduled for markup during a congressional hearing this week. Representative Don Young's main legislation would convey about 70,000 acres of Tongass National Forest timberlands to Sea Alaska. His smaller bill would turn over only a 20th of that acreage, but it calls for a faster-than-usual transfer. Sea Alaska has said it would provide enough timber to keep its logging business going. Spokesman Michael Anderson says Young wants to focus on the larger legislation.
We have the smaller bill waiting in the wings in case there's any sort of hang up with the larger one as the process goes forward, because the region and the industry needs to be sustained in the short term. So we're looking at every possible viable option at this point.
The Larger Sea Alaska measure is one of 14 land bills before the House Committee on Natural Resources, which meets Wednesday. The shorter measure is not scheduled for that hearing. The Senate is also expected to mark up its version of the Sea Alaska lands legislation soon. Robert Dillon, spokesman for sponsor Lisa Murkowski, says it's scheduled for June 18th before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, but he says that's tentative.
The bill isn't complete yet. And also, as well, there are a number of other bills that other senators on the committee, including Chairman Wyden, want to mark up during that session that aren't ready yet either.
That measure is co-sponsored by Senator Mark Begich. All the bills are controversial. Some environmental groups say they would badly damage fish and wildlife habitat. Small Prince of Wales Island area communities say it would devastate the landscape and threaten hunting and fishing. And several sportsmen groups say it would limit access to popular areas. Global voyager and Arctic adventurer David Scott Cowper of Newcastle, England, piloted the motor vessel Polar Bound through the normally frozen Northwest Passage last summer, the first pleasure craft to make that crossing through a portion of the passage called McClure Strait. For his 6 solo circumnavigations of the globe and 5 solo transits of the Northwest Passage, Cowper was honored this March by the Cruising Club of America with its Blue Water Medal. He made last year's journey with Jane Mauf, and the two have returned to Petersburg to prepare for another adventure through the Northwest Passage. Their vessel, the Polar Bound, spent the winter in Petersburg's North Harbor, where Joe Ficknicki found them back on board this week.
When I first set off to come through the Northwest Passage nearly 27 years ago, and how it took me 4 years to achieve undertaking a transit compared with now, when last year I came through in 21 days. And that says a lot about global warming, which is now progressing at a very fast speed.
You've taken pictures in your travels and you brought some of those along?
Yeah, there's lots of photographs of ice conditions, wildlife, polar bears, penguins down in Antarctica, elephant seals, sea lions, fur seals, leopard seals. So there's quite a variety of different photographs of scenic and of wildlife.
Are many of them from last year's voyage? Or?
Not so much, because last year, oddly enough, for the voyage was done mainly in fog. And the ice conditions weren't very impressive in photographs. It was just a little bit of sea ice, but not like 27 years ago where the whole, say, Lancaster Sound would be covered in ice as far as the eye could see. And also leads opening up, etc., etc. There's none of that, or pressure ridges at all. So, yes, the difference is changed very, very considerably.
Has this been a good place to leave the boat and base out of?
Oh, yes.
Excellent.
We've had all the facilities here, and as David was just saying, we've been quite overwhelmed by the hospitality that we've received on every hand. The local people, sailing people, fishing people around here have given us wonderful supplies of fish and prawns and crabs.
Yes.
And we've had a particular great kindness from a very nice couple called Grant and Lila Trask, who've opened their house to us and allowed us to use their facilities and are always ready with a smile to help us with all the things we need to do. I'm just coming back to what David was saying. The actual transit from the Davis Strait to the Bering Strait, which is the entire length of the Northwest Passage, actually took us 19 days, 19 hours and 20 minutes. And we hold the world record for being the first private boat to make the transit through the most northerly route possible. And actually, I was invited along because I'm a great niece of Sir John Franklin, who, as you probably know, lost his both his ships, the Erebus and the Terror, and all his men, and lost their lives from the hardships they encountered, and their ships, and they've never been; those two ships have never been found since. anyway, here we are in Petersburg, and we're about to set off, we hope, on an adventurous voyage north to revisit the route we took before, with a different outcome at the eastern end, which David is not prepared to speak about at this moment. He wishes to be the first person to complete the transit, if it ice allows it.
This is your second trip through, though, with him, and you're back on the boat. How does it feel?
This will be my second trip with him, and I can tell you that this morning, if you'd come, you'd have found me standing on my head trying to put a whole lot of stores down below when I thought we were already had a full cargo. But David is not prepared to take any risks, so we have to have spares for everything and enough food to go around the world with, probably twice over, I should imagine.
KFSK's Joe Wicknicki speaking with Arctic explorers David Scott Cowper and Jane Mauff. Most who saw it called it a blimp, but technically it was an airship. The environmental group Greenpeace inflated the floating billboard at Douglas Island Ballfield Saturday evening, then flew over Gastineau Channel to downtown Juneau and back. Greenpeace is in the capital city for a North Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting. The Washington, D.C.-based group is arguing for protection of deep canyons in the Bering Sea. Oceans campaign director John Hosevar says sponges, corals, and other deep-sea life are threatened by industrial fishing. He says Greenpeace has studied the canyon ecosystem and is presenting its results to the council. He says Greenpeace received Federal Aviation Administration permission to fly over Gastineau Channel, where cruise ships sail and float planes fly. And that's all for Raven News. If you've missed any of our stories or you'd like to hear them again, please visit us online at kcaw.org. And you are listening to KCAW here in Sitka.